This episode of Post Show Recaps is sponsored by The Crown, The Official Companion, Volume 1. Discover the real history behind the Emmy Award-winning Netflix original series The Crown with The Official Companion book out now from the show's historical consultant, Robert Lacey. Exploring the reign of Queen Elizabeth II and filled with historical context and beautiful archival photos, The Crown, The Official Companion is the perfect book for any fan of the show, available wherever books are sold. The wait for The Crown Season 2 is over, but we're just getting started here on The Crown Season 2 post-show recap. And now, here are the two guys who are ready for Queen Elizabeth II season. I'm Rob Sestrudino here with Taryn Armstrong. Taryn, how are you?
I'm good. Happy to be talking more Crown.
Yes. Taryn, that we are so sophisticated talking about The Crown once again. Look at us.
Yeah, I feel like it adds to like a certain amount of prestige of podcasting that we're discussing proper British royalty.
Yes. Okay. We're very excited to be back once again talking about The Crown. If you missed it last week, Taryn and I had a great conversation with royal historian Robert Lacey. He is the author of the book, The Crown, The Official Companion, Volume 1, which is the sponsor of this podcast, Elizabeth II, Winston Churchill, and the Making of a Young Queen, 1947 to 1955. That book is available wherever books are sold, and it is sort of the historical backdrop of The Crown Season 1. And The Crown Season 2 dropped on Netflix this past Friday, and we'll be talking about the first few hours of The Crown Season 2. We're mostly going to talk about the first 3 hours of the show. And so if you are super spoiler averse, I would say that maybe you want to listen to this after you've watched the first few hours of The Crown. But really, Taryn, I mean, the spoilers for The Crown have been long leaked. It's called Wikipedia.
Yeah. Any book
all
including
out there.
Including the companion guide.
Yes. Yes. Big spoiler, Queen Elizabeth II is still alive. So is Philip.
Oof. Man, so much tension just was taken away.
Sorry. I'm sorry. So feel free to listen. I mean, I really think that the great thing about The Crown is it is a show that almost can't be spoiled. Because that you know the history, or a lot of times you are learning the history along the way, and it's not even about the plot points to me. I think it's about sort of the performances and the drama and the execution of how this is all done. So feel free to listen, even if you have not yet checked out Season 2 of The Crown on Netflix.
Yeah, and I will honestly say, I think that knowing the history actually makes the show better, because I think the show, while it is informative in a lot of ways, it's also like, it kind of assumes that you know some of what it's talking about. I think it also assumes that you will be either reading a companion book or like, you know, on Wikipedia the entire time. But like, I think like knowing some of the background really helps you enjoy like some of the moments that it packs in that you maybe wouldn't quite land as well if you didn't know already.
Yeah. And I'm somebody who really did not know a lot of the history associated with this. And then it has been fun for me to sort of like get that education and go on and learn more about these things. And then I've even, you know, done some rewatching of some like, oh, OK, it makes a lot more sense. That is one of the great reasons why Robert's book for the first season was so helpful.
Oh, yeah. I'm already like I was annoyed that I didn't have the second one like on hand while I was watching season two.
Yeah. Okay. So, Taryn, I guess let's talk a little bit about sort of the big picture of season two as The Crown comes back. Of course, The Crown, I believe, is going to be 6 seasons long, where it is going to really explore the entire life of Queen Elizabeth II. Season two is here. And of course, that this is the big budget. I believe that this is $13 million an episode for each episode of The Crown.
It's crazy.
It is crazy. And the highly anticipated return is here. Of course, this podcast is sponsored by The Crown, the official companion, Volume 1. Journey beyond the palace gates for an in-depth exploration of the Emmy Award-winning Netflix original series, The Crown, with the official companion book by the show's historical consultant, Robert Lacey. Filled with historical context, beautifully reproduced archival photos and show stills, The Crown, the official companion, is available now wherever books are sold. Taryn, really, season two of The Crown jumps right into some turmoil in the marriage of Queen Elizabeth and Philip. And we start with a scene which is actually a flash forward to then the events that are going to be taking place over the next couple of episodes. And some marital discord, Taryn.
Yeah, this is, it's interesting. This is the first time we've seen this kind of narrative play out on the show, I believe, where they're really like playing with teasing you about all this turmoil and tension and then going back and showing you how it happened, which actually I think was very effective because then you then see like the good parts and the bad parts and you know what's about to come and it fills you with so much dread.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's a lot of cold opens in The Crown. And in season one, there were a lot of cold opens that were sort of Elizabeth as a child or, you know, different things that happened in the past. And then we sort of jump to the present in the story. But this was, you know, a la season three in Lost. We did a little bit of a flash forward and then went backwards.
Yeah, we have to go back.
We have to go back. We have to go back to 5 months earlier to see yes. You know, where we're going to begin Philip going off on this expedition that he gets sent on. Now, the character of Philip to me, Taryn, you know, you and I talked about this a little bit in our season one recap that, you know, it looked as though that we were going to get more of this in season one where, you know, Philip seemed unhappy and he felt like that he could not really be free in this life that he was living with Elizabeth. And really, it manifested itself in season one. He wanted to go fly the plane and he couldn't get away to go fly the plane. And sort of the, you know, monarchy was putting restrictions on him. And Elizabeth seemed OK with the idea of she wanted him to go and express himself and go fly the plane. But once again, he is feeling a little bit like that he's not able to be the person he wants to be.
Yeah, it's a very interesting, like, I find the character of Prince Philip so interesting because but when I watched the first season the first time, I was unaware of what happened with him. And I just, like, the way that he was being perceived when I looked at it from a narrative perspective, or the way I was perceiving him, it was that, like, he was going to be this, like, this evil character at some point because, like, there were so many hints that, like, he was going to do something bad and, like, he's jealous and he's insecure. And so I really felt like, okay, this, everybody hates this guy, clearly, because they're portraying him in such a way. But there were also moments where he was so good and so nice. And so I got a little confused. And then when I found out that he was still married to the queen and that, like, he's a relatively beloved figure, as far as I'm aware, I was like, whoa, that's so strange. And it makes more sense now because, it, you know, again, like, knowing the history and watching the show, they have to walk this fine line between, like, you know, we know that this guy probably felt like this. We heard some rumors of this and we heard some interesting stories about, like, maybe he had some infidelity here or there somewhere, but we don't know for sure. So they really have to, like, walk this line, and you see, like, the really good sides of Philip, but also these sides of jealousy and insecurity. And it's really interesting to watch.
Yeah, the show paints a pretty complex picture here. And, you know, we really get both sides of it where they don't really throw Philip under the bus to be like a complete heel. And while I think that everybody is really sympathetic to the protagonist in the story, which is Queen Elizabeth, you get sort of hints about Philip's infidelity, but we don't see him ever brazenly cheating on her.
Yeah. And as far as I'm aware, There were rumors at the time, but that's, again, from what I read, like fairly common for the royalty to have rumors about infidelity. Nothing was ever proven as far as I'm aware. Like, it's kind of discredited. Nobody, or I guess some people might believe it, but you know, again, like nothing was ever really proven. I think a lot of historians feel like probably nothing ever happened. But it was definitely like there was something here, right? And there was, you know, his friend who did have some infidelity happen, and that letter is real. So it's a very like confusing, like how do they want to portray this? And I think they really did walk that line pretty well, where, you know, she finds this this photo of the ballet dancer, and what could that mean? Because that could mean a lot of different things. And you know, he's off, and we know that he feels slighted by the fact that he feels like a kept, you know, guy, that he's beholden to his wife, who has rank over him. His own son has rank over him. But at the same time, we see him feeling homesick, and really, like, you can tell that he loves the queen as well. So it's very interesting.
Yeah. Did you find Philip to be whiny here in season two? Do you feel like that he was a little bit poor me?
Yeah. And I mean, I feel like that's, again, if we're looking at the two sides of him, I feel like the side of him that's like, I'm not going to bow to my wife during her, you know, her whole ceremony and everything, like that's the side of Philip when he's like, you know, my own son outranks me or whatever. Like, oh, who cares? Like, why is that really so terrible? Like, you need to, like, you know, your manhood can't take it, I guess. Like, and I think that's something that we're supposed to feel like, come on, Philip. But then at the same time, you can understand where those feelings might come from when he's trying to fly a plane and he's not allowed to, when he's, you know, when he wants to live in his own house and he's not allowed to. And there's so many things that are restricted to him, and he had to give up all of his own titles, and he really has to play second fiddle. And you can understand where that frustration comes from, but the way that he expresses it, especially in the show, is kind of like, all right, crybaby, like, let's discuss this in a more mature way.
So I think this is something that would be very interesting to hear from somebody like a Robert Lacey as to, like, what is actually known about Philip and his potential infidelity, and what are just rumors. And, you know, for me, you said, like, well, maybe there's a lot of different reasons why he has the picture of the ballerina in his bag. I don't really know if there's a lot of reasons why he has the picture of the ballerina in his bag.
Well, I mean, I think the show is definitely trying to imply that there are nefarious reasons. But again, as far as like history is concerned, from what I read, like this dancer in particular, like, vehemently denied any, you know, nefarious dealings with Philip.
Well, yeah, she doesn't want anybody to, the queen to be, you know, coming down there again.
Yeah, well, but what I mean is, like, there were other rumors, like the one that they discuss, I think, toward the end of episode three, where, like, he had met this woman in her apartment a few times, that were a little more credible in terms of, like, people actually thinking this might have happened. But I think the implication is, like, there's it's strong enough that obviously it's going to put some doubt into even the queen's mind herself. Because why wouldn't you? When so many people are, you know, saying, like, oh man, this guy, and he's out by himself, and he's clearly resentful of a lot of different things, you can see why she would react in the way that she does. And, like, oh boy, Claire Foy in that scene when she sees the picture, I was like, that was amazing. The performance that she gave throughout the entire three episodes, I thought was, like, it even blew me away from, like, watching her in season one. I thought she was even better.
Yeah, oh boy, Claire Foy, I think right now is the leading contender for the hashtag. Taryn, did you want to go off on one of these Prince Philip expeditions now?
I don't know. It seems like the company isn't the best in the world. Like, guys writing home bragging about, you know, their exploits when they're married. I'm not too fond of, you know, the beard growing, contest. It's all very manly. And I don't know if that's really me.
Right. And we see the thing that ends up really accelerating all of these problems here for Elizabeth and Philip is that there's this letter that gets intercepted. I mean, Mike, who is Philip's best friend, a real ass going on these trips and then like bragging about this to his pen pal.
Yeah, exactly. And especially like the proximity that you have to this guy who is married to the queen, like you got to be more discreet, dude.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, obviously don't do it in the first place. But if you're going to, why are you writing and bragging about it to these guys? Like, oh, they promised that they would be like discreet about it. Like, are you serious? Come on.
Philip needs a new turtle in his entourage.
Yeah, exactly.
He's got a lame entourage overall. We see a lot of stuff going on with the political factions and the big story, which dominates the action, at least through the first couple episodes, is the business with the Suez Canal. We saw power change hands among the prime ministers at the end of season one. Anthony Eden becomes the prime minister. He is really gung-ho about going after, striking first in Egypt with this Suez Canal. Did you find that to be a compelling part of the story?
I definitely found the scene where they take the Suez Canal to be very compelling. I really enjoyed that. I thought it paired with really well with the speech. I did find that it kind of like fizzled out a little too quickly. Like I wasn't like it felt like it was over before it started. And from like reading what happened in history, Anthony Eden is like a disgraced former prime minister, and I definitely got the sense that like people were angry with him, but I didn't realize just like how much people blamed him for this whole incident. It really it felt more like a maneuver by the new prime minister who takes his place, more so than it did like Eden really, like a study of how Eden really fell from grace when he was waiting so long to take over as prime minister from Churchill. And then he finally gets his chance and he's just immediately cut down. He takes it as a personal insult and he feels like he needs to strike and get out from under Winston's shadow and then just completely blows it. And part of that is due to his health. And apparently he was taking a lot of drugs for his illnesses and his mental status just quickly declined. And I don't know if we saw the extent of that as much as I guess I would have liked.
Yeah, I felt like that he was done in more by his health problems necessarily than everybody turning against him. But then when he goes back to go meet with everybody else to discuss what's going on with the government, basically Harold Macmillan, who will be the new prime minister, a.k.a. Maester Qyburn, he ends up really just like turning on Eden, and that was it. You can't trust Qyburn.
Oh, clearly not. I didn't. I knew I recognized him, but I couldn't quite place where it was from. But it makes complete sense that he's Qyburn.
Yeah, Qyburn is the new prime minister. For me, I would say that the prime minister and the political maneuverings that happen in season two, I don't feel like that they were as interesting to me as the stuff that's going on in season one. And I think that has to do with the strength of John Lithgow as Winston Churchill. With all due respect to Maester Qyburn, that I felt like that I wasn't as interested in what was going on with those guys as I was with the stuff going on. I was just as interested in Winston Churchill as I was with Elizabeth in season one.
Yeah, and I think that's probably like due in large amount to the fact that these people aren't as notable as Winston Churchill. Like he was such a huge figure, so there's an automatic like gravitas plus the performance, obviously. So you know you like seeing Churchill. These people are like who's this guy? Like we're learning about them, and then in the case of Anthony Eden, like it felt like there was a bit of a build up from season one, and like okay, now he's gonna take over, and then just like that in a couple episodes he was done. So yeah, I definitely feel what you're saying.
Okay, what did you think of the compromise that ultimately when we see Elizabeth and Philip work out, where then Philip is going to at least be elevated in title to prince. Do you feel like that was enough to get him to sort of stop going out and needing to keep pushing the boundaries of, you know, what he could get away with?
I feel like he thought it might be, but I think, I don't know, I got the sense from the scene and from the performance that even during the ceremony itself, he was looking at the crowd and sort of seeing still that, like, just because this is happening doesn't mean he's getting their respect automatically. And so I don't think it's going to be enough to tide him over. And, you know, props to the show, because during that argument, when she is asking him, like, what will it take? I really wanted him to just be like, it's like, we're not going to make a deal, like, let's work through this as a you know, a couple. And then I was so disappointed in him when he, like, actually proposed, like, okay, make me you know, a prince or whatever, because, like, I felt like, no, you have good in you. Why are you sinking down to this level? And I don't think it's going to help. Like, I don't think this is not going to alleviate his concerns. It's all of the same things are going to be happening. It's just he has a different title now. So I think we're going to continue to run into issues.
I think that my favorite character on The Crown, I love Princess Margaret. I can't get enough that I've gone a little bit further past the first couple episodes. She has a really great episode in the fourth episode, and we don't really see a lot with the captain from the first season that she was attempting to marry. But I really just love her as the character. She's just so different than Elizabeth. Robert Lacey said in our podcast last week that he thought it would have been a disaster if Margaret was the queen and not Elizabeth. And I really love Margaret as sort of like the black sheep of the family.
Yeah, and again, it's interesting watching this from a more modern perspective, because especially in the first season, I felt like I identified so much more with Margaret in terms of like she wanted to do things, again, in the same way that I did with Philip when he wanted to modernize things. Like, I liked that she was rebellious toward this, like, seemingly oppressive regime of, you know, proper etiquette, and like, the crown needs to be the crown, and we need to maintain its prestige. I was like, why can't it be more human? Like, why can't you do this? And so I think that's interesting, because at the same time, I've like come around to this idea that, like, maybe back then this really is what they had to do. And who knows, maybe the monarchy would have been, you know, destroyed if Margaret had become queen and tried to make it more human. And it's an interesting juxtaposition of who I relate to more and like who is seen as like the more moral person in the series.
And then not just morally, but just in terms of appearance wise, I think that there's this great fundamental battle between Margaret and Elizabeth. And I think that one of the things that comes up thematically in the series is, you know, how approachable and relatable should the royals be? Is it Elizabeth's job to sort of make herself be able to, you know, be relatable to the person? And there are scenes that go on with Margaret in the show where they're trying to, you know, photograph her a certain way because they feel like that the whole purpose of having this royal family is to inspire the common folk, because you have these people who are going about their day-to-day lives, and just the fact that they could imagine for a moment, oh, what must it be like to be Elizabeth or Margaret or any of the people in the royal family, that gives their lives this significance and something to dream about, to forget about the mundane. But on the other hand, there's this idea of they're so unrelatable that people come to despise them and people come to resent them. Why do they have this opulent life when I'm suffering? And I think we'll see those forces, you know, and I think that that's something that still continues in modern day society, of that finding that balance between relatable and idealistic.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And it's an interesting concept, especially since they really are in many ways like the celebrities of their day, of their country, even. Like, you know, people follow the gossip like they are celebrities. And to this day, like, when a prince announces his engagement, it's like, it's newsworthy. It's sort of like the classy gossip column, right? Like what's going on with the royal family? And they're still trying to strike that balance, I imagine, because on one hand, it seems very condescending to be like, we can't be too relatable because they need something to look up to. But on the other hand, if you are too relatable, I feel like you do lose some of the mystique that makes that gives you the power that you have. So I think it's it was probably difficult to find the right balance back then, but I imagine it's almost even more difficult to find the right balance now because of how accessible everybody is with social media, with the internet. So many people are more accessible, and celebrity itself has sort of degraded in terms of like how powerful it is. So it must be a very interesting thing that I imagine is playing out as we speak.
Yeah. And Elizabeth, while she's always reluctant to go to that place of, you know, we saw her very much in season one of, you know, they don't want to get to know, like, they don't want to see the real me. This was something that she talked about with Margaret back in the first season, where Margaret was acting in the Queen's absence, and she was like giving these like press conferences and like joking around with reporters, and everybody was really unhappy with that. Elizabeth felt like, no, it's my job to just portray this part of the Queen. But, you know, in terms of people giving her this type of feedback, she's open to considering it. And I think that that's one of the things that has made her this ruler, which has been able to stand the test of time. A woman who came into power in the 1940s still is, you know, been able to hold on to that position still in 2017.
Yeah, I mean, I think she really was in many ways like the perfect person to withstand so much change in British culture. They really,
in the world,
they started certainly the world as well. But like, especially with what happened with British culture, like when she inherited the crown, they were still very much like the sort of imperialist, in many ways, still the imperialist country that they were. And they lost a lot of that prestige and power, I think, over the course of the century. And some of that starts with, or at least is amplified by, the Suez Canal incident. And, you know, being able to maintain the pride that you have in your country is partly to do with how well the Queen has managed to, you know, stick with it and be the person that they needed her to be. And, you know, it does feel like everything she did was, you know, partly, you know, calculated in some way, like how relatable should I be? Like how unattainable should I be? And then also just like her willingness to really, like, I mean, as we see with the relationship with Philip, and that's why I think it's so interesting, is that she really does basically sacrifice who she used to be in order to mold herself into whatever she needs to be for the crown to work. And I think that's why this is a series that can span from, you know, way back when she takes the crown to present day, because she is able to survive and she's able to adapt to whatever it needs, whatever the crown demands of her.
And I think one of the reasons why she's been able to persevere so well, and I think that this is really well illustrated by the performance of Claire Foy, is that no matter what happens to Elizabeth, like in a public setting, she never lapses in terms of like flying off the handle. Like any piece of news that she gets, good or bad, in a public setting is almost always received with a, oh. That's, you know, it's almost the same reaction. And it's really very rare that we even see any sort of big emotional reaction come from her. And most of the time it's in the scenes with her, just with Philip. There's a few other isolated incidences, But she is mostly, for the most part, she is just like this blank canvas and doesn't reveal her cards, and then will often like process the information that's going on and then come up with a decision which might have been different than the way she was initially thinking.
Yeah, and again, that's part of how, like, just how amazing I think Claire Foy is in the portrayal, where you're able to see basically like the emotions that she's having to go through, but also like there's so much that she's holding back, there's so much that she's trying to control no matter where she is, no matter what she's doing. Like she has that meeting with Anthony Eden shortly after she discovers the photo in Philip's briefcase, and you can see that she is still very much like the stoic, queen character. But underneath that is this like emotional turmoil that she's going through. And Claire Foy is just amazing in how she's been able to portray all of that.
Taryn, one of the big themes from the first season of The Crown, which comes up here again, mostly through the story of Mike and Eileen in the first couple episodes, is sort of the fear of divorce among the British royals. And of course, that was a big part of Margaret's storyline back in the first season. And Eileen Parker is going to request a divorce from Mike Parker. And of course, that is the best friend of Philip. And that is going to set off a whole nother scandal in the tabloids.
Yeah, it's always surprising to me when I watch the show, like just how much they care about divorce and like
the
image of it. Yeah, and like when she goes to the lawyer and she's like, I would like to file for divorce, and he's like, it has to be one of three reasons. And what about like neglect? He hasn't been here. All of them, like, not good enough. You need to find proof of infidelity if you want to be able to divorce this person. And then all of the private secretaries and everything were oh my god, this is the nightmare. Like Philip's friend is going to go through a divorce, yep, because of infidelity. Like that's insane. This is the one of the worst things we've had to deal with. And they have to like call back Tommy LaSalle to come in and fix the problem for them. And he's like, oh man, this is the first time I've had to save somebody else's marriage in order to maintain the prestige of the crown or whatever it is. And it's crazy just like how like much they just meddled with people's personal lives and how much they cared about divorce. And I can't wait until whenever it is that just people are just allowed to be divorced. Like it's going to take so much dramatic weight off of so many of these scandals.
Yeah. And this is something that comes up in one of the later episodes where the topic of, what is the ultimate issue with divorce? And so you have Elizabeth and the being the part of the monarchy, which is also part of the Church of England, and the church is so against divorce, in the eyes of the church. So as sort of like this figure that represents the church, that's the main issue with having any sort of divorce going on. So that's why it's so problematic for the royal family.
Yeah, and it just really shocks me, just like the rules. You're watching it and sometimes it seems so modern and sometimes it seems so like old fashioned. Like, I noticed that spousal abuse wasn't one of the terms that you could file for divorce. Like, it was like, no, an infidelity or like improper actions. Maybe that would be abuse, but, who knows with these guys?
Yeah. And we end up seeing Mike Parker. He's a horrible guy. I think that Philip could get a better friend.
Yeah, exactly. And that's part of it, where it's like they walk that line and they show you just like why is this guy his friend? And like, even when he's on the ship after after the queen gives her speech and Philip's feeling homesick, you know, he talks with his friend Mike, and he clearly feels a little bit ashamed to admit that he's homesick. And right after he says it, Mike just is kind of like, yeah, you're feeling homesick. All right. I'm just going to leave then. Like, that's not good for me. Like, I'm no good to talk about with that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And from the Eileen side of things, we have that scene where Elizabeth goes and talks to Eileen and sort of asks her, hey, can you just sort of, you know, hold off on the divorce announcement because of the tabloids and everything? And Eileen basically tells Elizabeth, like, no, I can't wait. I mean, do you know how many things I've sacrificed for this royal family? And I think that that's also one of the major themes of the show, that the price that people, from the people that are in the family and outside of the family, just the toll that having this monarchy takes on all these different people. And whether or not, I mean, I guess that it is worth the price, but there are so many lives that are affected by the monarchy, and the people like Elizabeth and Philip, like, they don't even have any idea of what a toll it takes on all these other people that are involved.
Yeah, I loved watching Eileen just stand up to the queen and just be like, no, I'm not going to do this. It was basically what I wanted to see Margaret do last season. And just like, no, I'm not going to let you people just control my life for the sake of propriety. Like, I'm going to do what I need to do. You can't just tell me to stay with this husband that mistreats me. And I, like, I'm miserable in this marriage. I want to see more of that.
Okay, looking ahead to the rest of season two, Taryn, obviously, we need to see what ultimately happens with the trials and tribulations of the marriage between Elizabeth and Philip. But we have some exciting cameos coming later on in season two that I had gotten up to. Billy Graham showing up in season two, played by Paul Sparks, who, to me, best known as Yates from House of Cards.
Oh, my.
Yes. The right. Did you ever make it that far into House of Cards?
I'm trying
to
remember.
He is the writer. He was the guy who they hired, not to spoil anything House of Cards, but he's the guy that Frank Underwood hires to be his biographer.
Yes, this guy.
Yes, that guy. he shows up and he's Billy Graham. And then also, the exciting news that, JFK is going to be showing up later on in season two, played by Michael C. Hall.
Yes, I am a huge 6 Feet Under fan. I love Michael C. Hall as Dexter, so I'm very excited to see his portrayal of John F. Kennedy, although I haven't heard the best things in the world.
Yes. Oh, of his portrayal of John F. Kennedy?
Yeah, I've heard it's a little. I'm not believing the hype yet. I want to see it for myself because I have faith in Michael C.
What, you're hearing good hype or
bad hype?
Bad hype.
Yeah.
Okay, I have to check that out and finish watching The Crown. I have to say, overall, The Crown season two, that I feel like a little bit, I was like, like through the first episode, and then I got into like the second or third episode, then I just wanted to keep going.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it took me a little while to get into the first season and, like, get used to what was going on. And then, like, the rewatch was much better. And so now that I'm, like, in the mindset and I understand, like, what I need to do to, like, really fully enjoy the show, it's been much more capable of, like, grabbing me from the start. So I'm on board this season.
Okay. Well, I'm very much looking forward to going ahead and finishing the series here over the next couple of days. Tara, anything else you want to touch on from what you've seen of The Crown season two?
Well, I will say there's another show that, if you like The Crown, you may enjoy this. It's called The Hour, where the Suez Canal plays a large role in that show as well. It's another British show that takes place at around the same era, and it's about these newscasters. It's very good. I recommend it.
Okay. I want to thank again our sponsor for the special coverage of The Crown Season 2, and that is The Crown, The Official Companion, Volume 1, Elizabeth II, Winston Churchill, and The Making of a Young Queen. Wondering if John Lithgow's Winston Churchill is on point, or if Claire Foy is getting the Queen's English quite right? With The Crown, The Official Companion book, you'll get in-depth history behind the Emmy Award-winning Netflix series, complete with beautifully reproduced archival photos and show stills. The Crown, The Official Companion is available now, and the perfect book for any fan of the show, available wherever books are sold. Taryn, this was a lot of fun to go through The Crown. Worth the wait for season two.
Yes, and I'm going to be waiting for that the second volume of this this companion novel, so that I can really dig my teeth into this season two.
Okay, well,
the extras.
Yes. All right. Well, we have Robert Lacey's phone number from when we did the last podcast with him. I might have to text him some questions that I have. I can't wait for the second book to get the answer to some of this stuff.
That's true. We should just schedule another interview.
We'll just cold call. Like, hello? Who's this? Remember those guys you talked to, Rob and Taryn? We have questions for you. We just finished The Crown Season 2. Taryn, great job with everything here today. If you want to follow Taryn on Twitter, he is at Armstrong Taryn. I am at Rob Sesternino, of course. Check out The Crown, The Official Companion, Volume 1 for everything you need to know about the first season of The Crown, available wherever books are sold. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.